Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, exploring public management issues facing us today. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. This edition has as its backdrop a period rife with significant challenges that go to the very core of effective public management. Faced with seemingly intractable issues such as the ever-growing federal deficit, economic uncertainty, unemployment, and an aging infrastructure, it appears that the old adage, doing more with less, has taken on a whole new reality. Addressing the challenges arising from this new reality brings with it opportunities to try different approaches, borrow new strategies, forego old ways of doing things, and leverage seemingly incongruous practices to ameliorate otherwise vexing problems. Today, we've assembled a varied group of leaders, innovators, practitioners, and thinkers who, in their own way, offer models to follow, provide insights that can infuse theory to practice, and pave the way to shaping the business of government. First up, Conversation with Leaders, featuring dedicated public servants who share their extended reflections on the work they do and the service they perform. Investing in cutting-edge technology is even more important today than ever before, as NASA develops missions of increasing complexity to understand the Earth, our solar system, and the universe. I had the pleasure to speak with Dr. Bobby Braun, chief technologist at NASA, about his efforts to reinvigorate the space technology program and lead the office of chief technologist.
Yeah, the office is new and the position is new. They were created in February of 2010. There actually was a chief technologist about a decade ago. In the past decade, NASA's research and technology investments have been down a little bit as the agency became more and more mission focused. And this administration and frankly, the NASA administrator recognized that. And they wanted to rebuild the research and technology competency. And so they recreated the Office of the Chief Technologist to lead the charge in doing just that. We have two major functions that I'll point out. One is we're responsible for integrating the technology investments across the agency, across the mission directorates at NASA, to make sure that we're doing things in a coordinated and integrated fashion. And then we're also responsible for managing a new budget line that's in the president's budget request for 2011 called the Space Technology Program. In the president's budget request for 2011, that's about $572 million. And over a five-year period, it's about $5 billion for space technology within NASA.
Dr. Braun explains his role and the importance of technology in everything NASA does.
I report to the NASA administrator, and I'm his advisor in all technology matters across the agency. Technology is a part of everything we do at NASA, whether we're talking about aeronautics, science, or exploration. And I take more of a strategic view for the future of the agency and the importance of technology in that future. I'm managing the new space technology program. It's a new approach for technology investments. It's very different than the way NASA has done technology investments in the past. We're building on the lessons learned from organizations like DARPA and ARPA-E, and we're applying that type of model within NASA really for the first time. So it's very exciting.
This excitement has as its genesis a strategic vision that seeks to rebalance near-term mission and far-term technology innovation.
We're actually doing that balance across NASA. The space technology program is focused on those long-term investments. We are investing in a portfolio of technologies that are broadly applicable. And these are technologies that could affect not the next science mission, let's say, or the next exploration mission, but a suite of missions 5 or 10 years from now. Within the mission directorates, within each mission directorate at NASA, and there are four, there's the Aeronautics Mission Directorate, the Science Mission Directorate, the Exploration Systems Mission Directorate, and the Space Operations Mission Directorate. Within those four mission directorates, they invest in what I would call near-term or mission-focused technology. What's been missing is this longer-term or more strategic set of technology investments. And so together, between the new space technology program and the technology programs within the mission directorates, overall, NASA has a good balance between near-term and far-term technology development.
So with such a new and critical mission, what is being done to cultivate a risk-tolerant environment that fosters innovation at NASA? Once again, Dr. Bobby Braun.
Yeah, well, that is incredibly important to what we're doing. What does acceptable risk mean to a technology development program? And this is part of the cultural challenge that I think that I have and that we're working on. The way I view it is we need to have more of a tiered risk acceptance approach to NASA. And as you move into technology development, we certainly need to be able to take more risk. If we don't take risk in our technology development program, well, we certainly won't be developing game changers. The only way I know to innovate is to take risk. The only way I know to make progress towards a grand challenge or to develop a disruptive or game-changing technology is to take some risk. And with risk comes a higher probability of failure. So one of the things that we're doing in the space technology program is we're talking about this. We're saying straight up that we are going to fail. We're not going to fail with every investment. We have a broad portfolio of investments. What's important is that when we fail forward. We learn from that experience. A disruptive technology needs to come in there, and perhaps we skip a couple steps along the way. That's the model that we're shooting for, and that will only occur if we take some risk.
Since its inception in the summer of 1949, the Air Force Medical Service has sought to provide service members and their families with first-rate health care and benefits anywhere at any time. Today, under the leadership of Lieutenant General Bruce Green, that mission has become Trusted Care Anywhere.
And so I looked for a mantra, and Trusted Care Anywhere was what I thought really fit what we do. In large part, the challenges to achieve Trusted Care Anywhere are to create a system that can be taken anywhere in the world and be just as useful, whether it's in war or in humanitarian assistance, and can create links back to the American standard of care, wherever that may be. And honestly, that's something that we can teach others to show better ways to interface. We always try to keep up in terms of maintaining the cutting edge in terms of our deployed medicine, our readiness mission. The secondary thing I would tell you is, in order to do that, I have the responsibility for training and equipping those medics so that they're ready to do that. And that involves trying to maintain state-of-the-art medicine back here at home. And no less than those two is the third mission, which is really to ensure a healthy force. And to do that, I have to basically leverage the very best in primary care to try and make certain that we are helping our beneficiaries stay healthy so that hopefully they don't need our assistance when they go overseas.
I spoke with Lieutenant General Green, Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force, about the central role AFMS plays in the most effective joint casualty care system in military history. A system that has saved thousands of lives that otherwise would have been lost on the battlefield.
The reality of our mission has always been for the Air Force to fly, fight, and win, and for the Air Force Medical Service to enable them to do that by creating health within our military force, and also to try and restore health whenever someone was injured in any way. And so, as you look at what our various missions have been, setting up hospitals and deploying our medics to somewhere far away, what's happened over the years is we've also picked up an air evacuation mission, which is a little broader than the Air Force because we also use air evacuation to bring back casualties from all the services. And so I'd say that right now the Air Force Medical Service critical mission in terms of what this country relies upon us for is for the air evacuation.
General Green elaborates on his efforts to take this life-saving capability to the next level.
My newest challenge to our folks is in our modular expeditionary medical capabilities to be able to see the first patient in an hour of the time they arrive and to do the first surgery within 3 hours. Today, it takes us 12 to 24 hours to accomplish those things in setting up a hospital in a deployed setting. On the AirVac side, when you're bringing people home and having them back in the States in 3 days, it's a little tough to beat that. But we're finding there are certain classes of patients that we need to be cautious with to make sure we don't move them too early, that we make sure their staging stops are where they can get the right care so that we never cause any harm, and that honestly, for other patients, if there's a way to get them home to their families quicker by using things like polar routes and different types of transportation, we're trying to leverage that as well.
General Green describes the best way to accomplish his goals and achieve this vision.
From my perspective, I think you have to be very attuned to the people. I think that you have to know kind of where they're coming from. When you're looking for innovation in particular, you have to bring teams of very talented individuals together and listen to what they say, hopefully leveraging their experience to find new ways of doing things. I find that when you bring people together in an environment where they feel safe and can talk about those things that are a little different or they wish was different, that we can make kind of remarkable things happen. More often than not, I find that I create a common vision for folks. I get them to come in and share their ideas, and then I leverage the information that they share so that we can create something new. The reality in terms of trying to find new solutions is to get people to feel safe, to build trust, and then have everyone take pride in the final solution set that you're able to put out.
In 2009, the U.S. Postal Service collected, sorted, and delivered more than 177 billion pieces of mail. Finding more sustainable ways to process this mail and lower the Postal Service carbon footprint continues to be a central goal. Sam Palcrano, Vice President of Sustainability at the U.S. Postal Service, explains his leadership in forging sustainable operations.
My current position was established in May of 2008, and at the same time when I was announced, we announced the formation of the Office of Sustainability. What I'm responsible for is unifying and pulling together the Postal Service's sustainability efforts across all the business units within our organization and across the organization as a whole. Our job is to coordinate, facilitate, and integrate activities across the business units to pull it all together, coordinate, tell our corporate story.
It's a corporate story that has as its backdrop a rich history of being a good steward of the environment.
We've always been a leader in using alternative fuel-capable vehicles and recycling in those arenas. In fact, we had the first electric vehicle. We tested that back in 1895, believe it or not, in Buffalo, New York. And we've been testing electric vehicles for almost 100 years now. Today, we have the largest alternative fuel-capable vehicle fleet in the world, and about 40,000 of those are ethanol fuel-capable as well. But I think what's important is because of our size and because we touch every community, it's essential and we have an obligation to embrace green ways of doing business, and it's our objective as an organization to ultimately become known as a world-class sustainability leader. And we also are very focused on continuing to adopt sustainable ways of improving and doing our business to create a long-term value for our customers, our employees, and all of the communities that we serve. Corporately, we have a goal of reducing our facility energy 30% by 2015, our petroleum fuel use 20% by 2015, also increasing our alternative fuel use 10% by 2015, and we recently, last year, set our own corporate goal of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions 20% by 2020.
Going green may make good environmental sense, but how does going green and employing a formal sustainability program make good business sense? Sam Palcrano, Vice President of Sustainability at the U.S. Postal Service, explains why.
It's been related to the economic environment that the world is in right now. There's two very key areas that we've been focused on. First and foremost, of course, is can we find some new ways of growing revenue for the organization? So we've been exploring things like mailback opportunities. And by mailback, I mean we're piloting in 1,500 post offices, providing prepaid postage envelopes for people to mail back their small electronics, cell phones, PDAs, etc., where they get properly recycled. The other area, of course, that's of significant importance to us is reducing our cost and being as efficient and lean as possible. Our mission is to provide universal service at affordable rates, so that helps us achieve that. And many of our green initiatives, we're focused on what we call no cost or low cost, but they impact the bottom line. So things like turning off the lights when they're not in use, turning off your computer monitors, adjusting the thermostats to required temperatures that we want in our particular facilities. We have a slogan. We call it reduce, reuse, and recycle. And it's becoming much more than just a slogan to us within the Postal Service. It's actually becoming a way of us doing our business.
As we continue to engage government executives outside the Beltway, I had the pleasure of speaking with Cass Holloway, Commissioner of the New York City Department of Environmental Protection, about how his agency ensures the city's water system is viable for the next 100 years.
DEP is a utility. We are a water and wastewater utility primarily. There are a couple of other important quality of life functions that we handle and that are central to our mission, like air quality, noise quality, things that really are about the everyday environment and quality of life for New Yorkers. But the majority of our operating budget, our capital budget, our infrastructure, our personnel, the 6,000 people who work for the agency, that is about water supply and wastewater treatment. We supply about 1 billion gallons of drinking water every day to New Yorkers. So when I think about the agency operations, it's really supply, which comes from our 19 reservoirs, distribution, which are those 6,600 miles of water mains and 7,400 miles of sewer mains, and then treatment, the 14 wastewater treatment plants.
The infrastructure needed to provide 8 million people clean, healthy drinking water is quite amazing. And so are the many challenges in doing just that. Cass Holloway highlights a few of these challenges.
Number one is performance measurement at the agency. One of the things that we're building at DEP now is a new Office of Strategic Planning that is putting together a comprehensive set of metrics across those four core areas to help you drive decision making across the agency, because resources are limited. And in order to prioritize, you really have to have the whole picture. Challenge number two, our capital program is huge. We have right now $11 billion in construction. We have $3 billion in design. I think there is some opportunity to bring some more discipline to our project design and execution process. So that's a huge challenge. Third, operating efficiency. I think one thing that I saw coming into the agency, there was to a certain degree silos, operating silos that I wanted to break down. Part of the issue with it is people don't take advantage of resources. People also get it in their mind that those resources are their resources, and that's not the case. They're the agency's resources, and we have to figure out how best to allocate them. The final challenge, the agency's relationship with its regulators and our stakeholders. I think for a long time, the attitude was, well, you can only get something done with DEP if you sue us. The mayor's philosophy on that is, you know, if you're litigating, you've lost.
At the recent Best of the Best water taste test, New York City garnered second place. The city continues to excel in this area, supplying high-quality water from mountaintop to tap. The New York City Department of Environmental Protection, under the leadership of Cass Holloway, makes this all possible.
DEP clearly does a good job. People turn on the tap, the water comes out. The water also goes away, and it tastes great. So in a sense, we're doing great by that measure.
Whether it's delivering a precious natural resource like water, finding sustainable ways to operate, saving lives on the battlefield, or pursuing disruptive innovation in space exploration, the conversations shared in this edition of the Business of Government magazine have much to offer about leadership, government, and public service. Next up, our Fall-Winter 2010 Profiles in Leadership, when the special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns.